K2RIW here, and along with K2KEY, ELF, we run this thing called the Technical Med. Main purpose of the Technical Med is to gather the clan, teach each other how things work, how to make things work better, how to get more enjoyment out of this particular hobby called ham radio. And there's 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM 2-meter repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. We quite often discuss a few of the other kinds. The kinds of subjects that are appropriate for the Technical Med are any subject of interest to radio amateurs, usually of a technical nature, usually involving wireless electronics, electronic tinkering, computers, things along these lines, even getting into television and high-definition television, and ham radio, fast scan, slow scan, and so on. A person signs into the Technical Med because he has a question or a comment for the net. He does so by saying his call letters, his name, I'm Sir Don Forgetful, and so you tell Mel and Dick your name, and you follow it with a yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, K2KEY, Mel and yes. So do we have any check-in tonight? Please give me a call letter and name right now. K2RIW.
KB2MAR, Gabe, yes.
YY, Joe, yes.
So far we have Gabe and Joe. Anyone else?
And two we out.
And Rich, that's probably with a yes. Is that true, Rich?
Yes, Dick, with a yes.
Kind of thought so. Okay, so we've got Gabe, Joe, Rich. Anyone else?
KC2CUS, Bill.
KC2MDP, Steve, no question.
With a no, when I do have a small space report.
Very fine. MDP recognized with a no. TVS, I think it is. What was your name again, sir? I can't read my writing. KC2TV, Tango Victor Sierra, is that? Go ahead.
KC2 Tango Uniform X-Ray, Bill.
Very fine, Bill. Now I can read my handwriting. And one last call. Anyone else with a check-in, give me a call letters and name right now.
N2RSO Frank, no.
And Frank recognized. Okay, the first person with a real question seems to be Gabe. KB2MAR. Go right ahead, Gabe. K2LIW.
K2RIW, KB2MAR. This question concerns the oil burner situation that you guys were talking about a month and a half ago, about leaning the oil burner for maximum efficiency. Just curious, let's say, for example, Beckett oil burner, are there any books that you can purchase that tells you step-by-step what to do? Or maybe you could tell me over the air in general what to do. KB2MAR, back to that.
Yes, I can, Gabe. I can give you quite a bit of that information. I can recommend a particular book to you which is not going to tell you everything you want to know, but it'll tell you a lot about what you want to know. And although this may sound like it's a little bit off subject, in my opinion, it's almost on subject for two or three reasons. One, a vast amount of the American public seems to have the misconception that the oil burner involves some kind of rocket science and is something that you can't maintain, improve, tinker with, or whatever. In that respect, it's a valid subject. Many of us have our ham radio shack in the basement with the oil burner, sometimes not very far away from the oil burner. And depending on whether or not the furnace, which is using oil to heat the house, or it could even be gas, but in the case of oil, is where the majority of the misadjustments take place. When a furnace is improperly set, it makes a lot of soot, it makes a fair amount of carbon monoxide, it contributes to global warming. The inefficiency is going to cost you more money, because oil is pretty expensive these days. Spending more money on oil because of inefficiency means you have less money left over to buy rigs and antennas. You can see how it kind of relates. Now, first of all, when it comes to a book that will give you quite a bit of information,
One of my favorite places is a group of stores on Long Island, and probably they're across the United States, called Sid Harvey, S-I-D space H-A-R-V-E-Y. Sid Harvey is a chain of stores which sells the components that are used by people who do oil burner and air conditioning maintenance. So when you go into a Sid Harvey store, it's intended for people who are in the business. You got to be a little bit careful not to ask too many questions so that you really demonstrate that you're a neophyte. I've never had the problem, but I think it's possible. They'll say that, hey, you're not in the business, you shouldn't be here. You will be paying tax because you don't have a tax release number or whatever it's called if you were really in the business. That's okay. But Sid Harvey does have about a 3/8 of an inch thick white book, 8.5 by 11 size. I wish I knew the name of it. If I go over to my bookshelf, I guess I can find it for you. It's something to do with oil burner maintenance, but it's got the The book has lots of illustrations as to how the oil burner system works. And the oil burner system of your furnace is relatively simple. That is to say, there's an oil tank which supplies the oil through a line, which, in my opinion, should go through two filters. A coarse salt type filter to get rid of the really big junk, and then one of these microfine filters, white, very fine type filter. And you don't want to use the white fine filter all by itself because it'll clog instantaneously. But with a pair of filters, you can make sure the fuel is nice and clean. And if the fuel is nice and clean before it enters your burner system, you'll almost never have trouble with a clogged nozzle. There is a final strainer, a sintered brass strainer in front of the nozzle, but you don't really want to be using that. And there's also a little basket strainer that's around the pump itself on the inside of the pump. You don't want to be using it because changing it is a pain. The external filters are much easier to change. So assuming you've got the right filters, in my case, I've also installed a gauge, a pressure gauge, correction, it's a vacuum gauge. The bolt that goes through the last filter, you replace the bolt with a hollow bolt that's supplied to you by the gauge manufacturer, and now you can measure inches of vacuum that the pump is creating when it's trying to extract the oil from the tank. The reason why that's handy is that if the filters become clogged, you'll start building up vacuum on that gauge, and it'll give you a clue. And in my case, because I've got a 61-year-old house, occasionally the oil line itself, which is about 30 feet long, back to the oil tank on the other end of the cellar, occasionally that oil line will clog. And they sell a CO2 device, a little CO2 cartridge device, for not very many dollars, which will allow you to blow high-pressure carbon dioxide back through that line to unclog it. My line seems to clog once every 3 years. And I guess it's sludge buildup in the tank itself. My tank is indoors. A person with a tank outdoors has the advantage that you can put a larger tank without losing a volume in the basement. Let me drop. But, I wish I had a 500 to 1,000 gallon tank, because when oil drops in price, I'd like to buy a whole lot of it, as opposed to, you know, the way Murphy's Law works. Your tank will run dry, so to speak, during the time that the oil is at the highest possible price. Now, when it comes to the burner itself, Erwin Dresner, why can't I think of Erwin's call letters right now? It'll come to me in a couple of minutes. Erwin Dresner had a contract from Brookhaven Laboratory about a decade or two ago in which he investigated a whole lot of oil burners on Long Island. He found a significant percentage of them were misset, where the nozzle itself was too large in gallons per hour, and the amount of air being directed through the flame was too little, so that a very smoky flame was being created. The disadvantage of the smoky flame is that you build up a whole lot of black soot. The black soot inside of the heat exchanger is a very big insulating material. Therefore, the amount of heat from the flame is not being transferred into the heat of your house as efficiently. You're contributing to soot in the air, global warming, smelly furnace, and so on. My particular furnace, let me drop. came with, I believe it was something close to 1 gallon per hour, was the size of the nozzle. And I've now cut it back to something like 6/10 of a gallon per hour. These nozzles, by the way, are about $2 or $3 each, and you should change the nozzle. That's the thing that takes the high pressure oil, sprays it into a fine mist so that the flames can properly burn it. And you want to get as fine a mist as possible so you get complete atomization and complete combustion. Okay, I've gone down to 6/10 of a gallon per hour nozzle. And when you go to the Sid Harvey store, you'll see a whole shelf full of these nozzles. You can buy 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, 0.75, 0.8, 0.9, 1, 1.2, and so on, gallons per hour. When you buy a nozzle, you buy the nozzle for the size of its orifice, that's gallons per hour. Also, you buy it for flare angle, 60 degrees, 70 degrees, flare angle. This is a function, it's not a super sensitive parameter, but it is part of the design of your furnace. Your furnace has a particular flare angle of the atomized fuel coming out of that nozzle as to what works best with your particular heat exchanger, firebox. And also, that's the cone angle, and they also come either solid or hollow cone. Again, it's part of the design. Whatever kind of nozzle you had been there before, I recommend you keep the exact same flare angle. If it was solid or hollow, I recommend you keep that, although you could do some experimenting along that, but I definitely recommend going to a smaller number of gallons per hour for two or three reasons. Let me drop it. And that I discovered that as you go to a smaller number of gallons per hour, it becomes a lot easier to supply the right amount of air. It's a lot easier to get finer atomization where you get a much cleaner burn. The slight disadvantage of a smaller number of gallons per hour is that, yes, the BTU output of your furnace is being decreased. And that, at first, sounds like a disadvantage. In my opinion, it's an advantage. The advantage is that a hell of a lot of people are putting up with a furnace where it's got a huge flame that's too large for the particular furnace itself, and therefore the darn thing roars and makes a whole lot of sounds and rumbling and whatever. I'm amazed how many houses I go into when the furnace comes on. Boy, it shakes the whole darn house. And how the residents of the house put up with that is just amazing to me. I bring it to their attention, and they say, well, it's always been that way. It doesn't bother me anymore. Now, all of that vibration has danger, in my opinion, because it can be shaking apart your chimney. It can shake apart the flue pipes. Nasty things can happen. And why should you have to put up with the sound and the incomplete combustion? When you go down to a smaller number of gallons per hour, yes, you have less BTUs output from the furnace. It means it's going to run a higher percentage of the time. It's going to take a little bit longer when the house hasn't been heated for a long time to bring it up to temperature. But whether it takes an hour to bring it up to temperature or an hour and a half, that's a minor detail. And the one last disadvantage of a small nozzle is that if you happen to get a high wind, super cold, minus 10 degree day, it's possible your house will only come up to 65 degrees instead of 75. On that particular one day per 3 years, you put on an extra coat. Big deal. But to have all this advantage all the other days of the year that you're running the furnace, in my opinion, you're ahead of the game. Now, when we discussed this subject about 2 months ago, 2 months ago, a number of people who are in the business also brought to our attention the fact that if you buy the right kind of a pressure gauge and install it correctly, temporarily, you can set the pump at 150 pounds per square inch of pressure instead of 100. When you do that, each of these nozzles that you use give better atomization and a little bit more gallons per hour. So maybe your 0.6 gallons per hour is going to become 0.7, but you're also going to get a much finer atomization and a much better clean burn. It takes a little bit of experimenting, but I discovered that the when the flame is set correctly for the right air mixture or a tiny bit lean, in other words, a little bit more air than required, instead of getting black soot in your flue pipes and on your furnace, it becomes a very light tan-colored material. The solid material that still exists in the oil when it's burned, there's very little of it, and it's a light tan color. It's a lot more pleasant to clean that out, and my furnace only needs cleaning not every single year. I replace the nozzle every year, and I do checking of things every year, but the cleaning is only required every 2, 3, 4 years when you get a clean enough burn. So there's a whole lot of advantages. I'm using a heck of a lot less gallons per hour. I've got a, I guess it's a little shy of a 2,000 square foot house, and I'm burning something in the vicinity of 600 gallons per year, and I keep my house at roughly 70 degrees in the wintertime. There's a heck of a lot of people that are burning a lot more oil than I am, and I don't have a well-insulated house. I've got all kinds of insulation I could be adding to the house. So these are some of the things that I think you'll discover. By the way, having the spare parts to be able to repair the oil burner, the only thing that can fail is that you get a clogged pipe, and the simple CO2 gun to clean it is easy. You get a clogged filter. Well, you make sure you have some spare filter elements. There's a slim possibility you'll get a failure of a nozzle. You'll have some spare nozzles. They're only a couple of dollars. And once every 7 or 8 years, I might get a failure of the ignition transformer. And so having a spare ignition transformer is easy. That's about all there is. It's not rocket science. If you can maintain electronics, you'll find... If you can maintain an automobile, I guarantee you can maintain your furnace. That's an opinion. Now, there's a little bit of liability risk here, because obviously a person who is all thumbs could take the information I've given you and do something that's really terrible. And so with a little bit of checking with other people who signed into this net, with some good questions, I think you'll find out more and more about this, if you so desire, Gabe. And I think we should, because as Erwin Dresner discovered, H-U-T-R-P is Erwin's call letters, he discovered that such a high percentage of furnaces are being improperly maintained, improperly set. And if you think about it, there's a huge conflict of interest. The guy who sells you the contract, which I don't have, the guy who sells you the oil, and tells you the oil and maintains your furnace, if he does a poor job so that you burn a lot more oil, he sells more oil and he makes more profit. There's a definite conflict of interest going on here. On top of that, I've discovered that a number of my friends where I told them they should be running a smaller nozzle so that they don't have to put up with that roaring sound out of their furnace, and they told it to their particular oil repair person, who basically cursed at them saying, "I know my business, leave me alone." That's what I call the ultimate closed-mindedness. I've always done it this way, and I'm going to keep doing it this way. KB2MAR, I bet you'll have a few more questions on this. K2RIW, go ahead, Gabe.
2DQI.
DQI recognized. Gabe first. Go ahead, Gabe.
Excellent information so far. I really appreciate that. By the way, that book, that white book you talked to me about, do you have it handy? Do you have the name of that book on your bookshelf there?
If I walk away from the rig for about 40 seconds, yes, I can pick it up. Let me find out what Mr. DQI is asking. K2DQI, if you're asking a question on this subject, start up your name, sir, and proceed with your question.
Okay, thank you, Dick. I'll make it fast. My name is Paul, November 2, Delta Queen, India, and I have a Sid Harvey's here in Mount Vernon, and they are wonderful to deal with. When I do my projects, they write me out diagrams and stuff. They're very helpful. I just want to thank you for the very informative net, Dick. It reminds me of when I was a teenager watching Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom and Ed Sullivan and Bonanza and Mission Impossible on a Sunday night back-to-back, and I always listened to this net. So thank you, Dick. Hope I didn't take up too much of your time. From Paul, N2DQI.
Paul, with a report like that, you should speak slowly, you should sign it often, and you should give us a report as often as you want. A little bit of a joke there, but thank you, Paul. Glad you appreciate it. When one of the next guys asks a slightly lengthy question, and I can walk around the house with a handy-talkie while listening to the question, I'll go over to my bookshelf, which is a few rooms away, Gabe. I'll pick up that book, and I'll get you the name. So there'll be a little bit of delay, but you're going to get the name for that one. That book. And as I said, the book is not the be-all, end-all. It's about a $10 or $12 book from Sid Harvey. It gives you a lot of basic information about how the furnace works, a little bit about how to clean it, how to disassemble it, how to make it work better. As I said, it's not a perfect book, but it will definitely help, in my opinion. So don't want you to be over-expecting that the book's going to tell you everything. Some of what I'm telling you now is not in that book. The people who do the service, the people who signed into the SecNet, and Joe has a list of those names, and I can, those call letters. And I did find that email last week. I can find it again. We can list the guys' call letters who are in the business, who have signed into the TechNet, and gave us additional pieces of information. With that list of names and with your amateur radio contacts by way of QRZ.com, when need be, you can call me or them on the phone, get additional information. And so, slowly, if you desire to, you can be as much of an expert in maintaining your furnace as you are at maintaining your car. There's an amazing number of amateurs that are extremely good at changing oil, changing batteries, changing windshield wipers, headlights, whatever. They can do a hell of a lot of the small maintenance. They're not changing transmissions and differentials and motors. But things shy of that, there's a heck of a lot of cost-saving measures you can use in automobile maintenance. And by the same token, you can eventually save quite a bit of money on maintaining your furnace, therefore have more money to buy rigs. That's an opinion. Let me go over to Joe while I'm going to go get that book. Some E2LYY. K2LIW. You got it, Joe.
Thank you, Dick. Well, since you're going to run off and buy one of your books, let me just take a break here in the net for about 30 seconds and give you breathers before I ask the question, okay?
Roger, Dodger. I'm going to be listening with a handy talkie, but we'll take a little bit. We'll take a 30-second break. We'll be back. I'll be back.
And 2GO T-Mobile for a check-in.
K2KY, WS2N.
Okay, evening call. WS2N and 2GOT, both recognized. Good evening, both of you fellas. And thank you for joining us here on TechNet. Dick went over to check on a book, and he shall be right back. How's everything going? Howie, I guess you were out to PEA this weekend. How's the trip for you? Are you just getting home? Over.
Mel, I was in Kennett Square in Longwood Gardens yesterday, and today I was up in Cold Spring, New York. I'm coming back home. I'm on the Sprainbrook right now, just out of Taconic, passing through Scarsdale. Just wanted to check in and say hello to everybody. Hope you're making the repeater okay.
Take 2 hours. I'll be back. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, go ahead, Dick. I just want to say hello to my friend Howard, and he's on his way back from upstate New York. So, good copy, Howie. Coming into the repeater very well. So, shows you the repeater has great range. Back to you, Dick. Continue with the oil burner story. Over.
Roger, Dodger. While I was away, a person did check in. The person who checked in, please give me your call letters and name one more time.
It might have been me, and I think Steve was in there. It's Howard and TGOT.
Yep, that was you. Very good, Howard. Okay. Dave, good news. I found the book. Got a little bit worried there because I didn't put it quite where I thought I did. And this book, as I said, is about a quarter inch, 3/8 of an inch thick, 8.5 by 11, white with a black line drawing on the front cover. It's entitled The Complete Guide to Residential Oil Heating. I'll repeat that. The Complete Guide to Residential Oil Heating. And under that it says Training Guide. Sid Harvey is the brand name on it, and it's part number 665. So Sid Harvey, part number 665, The Complete Guide to Residential Oil Heating Training Guide. Not a perfect book. In my opinion, it's an extremely good book. Lots of diagrams about how these systems work, how to maintain them, what's required to keep them in good shape, some of the details of what we have been telling you about higher pressure setting, slower number of gallons per hour, nozzle choices, and things like this, and my opinion on proper oil-air mixture. The books on the subject would lead you to believe that there is some extremely ideal, very fine setting for the air-oil mixture. And there's all kinds of instrumentation you can add to make sure that you're getting the hottest possible flame. Well, my philosophy is you do not want the highest possible temperature of flame. I know that sounds opposite of common sense. Let me drop. The highest possible temperature of flame would be that delicate balance of air and fuel where you're getting a good burn, but not an excellent burn. In other words, the droplet sizes of oil that are being atomized by that nozzle really represent a Gaussian distribution. In other words, a small percentage of big ones, a very small percentage of small ones, but a large percentage of medium-sized ones. When you've got just the right setting of the air-oil mixture, you're getting a good burn of the ones in the middle of the Gaussian curve. But the big ones on the left-hand side, you're not properly burning those, and they're making soot. You make the air mixture a little bit richer in air or a little bit finer in the oil-to-air mixture, you're going to get a more complete burn, but because you're adding more oil, more air, the flame is going to be a tiny bit cooler. But a tiny bit cooler flame that burns cleanly and doesn't make black soot, to me, is a very good trade-off because you're not building up the soot on the heat exchanger, which represents a big insulator. So in the big picture, in the long run, you come out ahead multiple ways. You're not making carbon monoxide, you're not making the smell, you're not making the soot, you're not making the rumble, and you're getting a cleaner burn. I'm willing to sacrifice a little bit of the temperature to come out that way by making it a little bit richer in air. But you got to be careful. If you overdo the air, you start blowing out the flame. And you don't want an intermittent flame that gets blown out periodically and has to be relit by the igniter. The igniter, by the way, is a 10,000-volt transformer going to these fine little points that are on a porcelain insulator that come out in front of the nozzle, and they create a spark. It's about a 3/16 of an inch wide spark, and that spark is what ignites the flame. And on most oil burners, the spark runs continuously just to make sure that even if the flame gets blown out, it can restart again very easily. And one other safety feature that every oil burner has, and one thing that you want to make sure you don't do anything to disturb its operation, and that is there is a photo detector in there. In other words, there is a circuit with a photo detector looking for the flame. And after the furnace has turned on and has run for, let's say, 20 seconds or so, if the photo detector does not detect a flame, it knows that something is It knows that something is wrong, and if the photo detector doesn't see a flame in about 10 or 20 seconds, the system will shut itself down. You have to reset that button by pressing it, which you should not do until you found out why it went off in the first place. I mean, it's very similar to you blow a fuse in the house and an unintelligent person will just plug in another fuse and blow the next one. Back in the days when you had cartridge fuses. Nowadays, everybody's got circuit breakers. That's not so bad, but you know what I mean. And one last thing that, in my opinion, is extremely important, and that is to buy for about $5 a delay turn-on oil switch. The pump creates the 150 pounds per square inch oil that gets roared down this little piece of pipe that goes into the nozzle, and it sprays the oil into your furnace. When the furnace turns off, that 150 pounds per square inch slowly dribbles down to 0 pounds per square inch, and therefore oil is dripping out of the end of the nozzle while the flame is still there. Improperly atomized, sooty oil mixture, which eventually makes a blob of black sooty stuff at the end of the nozzle, which is not good, and it jams up the end of the so-called blast tube, the thing that's directing air and fuel together. So you get this buildup of sludge because of the way the furnace turns off. Correspondingly, the next time it turns on, it takes a few seconds to build up the 100 pounds per square inch. And so, again, you're getting a very sloppy start. When you buy the right switch for about $5, and it's made by, can't think of the name of the company right now, it'll come to me in a few minutes, for about $5, you buy the switch which you put in the middle of that pipe. What it does is it delays the oil flow for about 5 seconds. The furnace turns on, the pump is coming up to speed, the blower is coming up to speed, and after about 5 seconds, it then suddenly opens up and lets the oil come roaring through the nozzle, and you get a nice clean atomization and burn. When the furnace turns off, the switch instantaneously closes even before the blower has had a chance to slow down and the pump has had a chance to slow down. It cuts off the oil flow to the nozzle very sharply at the instant the power turns off.
Step. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
As you can see, that's an extremely handy device to make sure that you're not making a lot of sludge and lousy burn and whatever. Almost every furnace nowadays that's in use does not have that oil switch on the high pressure line, and they all need it. I'd like to believe the new, brand new manufactured furnaces that claim high efficiency have that switch, but I'm a little bit skeptical. I don't see very much evidence that a significant percentage of the population has that switch. It's a small cost item that can save you an awful lot of grief. Back to you, Gabe, for any fill in all of that. KB2MAR, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Also, I was wondering, when is the maximum PSI allowed that will not cause any malfunction of the system? Can you go 200 PSI somehow, 250? Would that work, or would it just cause more trouble? Back to you.
Darn good question, Gabe, and maybe that's worth experimentation. Although I worry a little bit about now, the flare fitting on that piece of pipe, the nozzle itself, would it tolerate 200? And is the pump capable of going that high? I know that the pump itself is most frequently used at 100 pounds per square inch, and the people in the service business have discovered they get a much finer operation when they readjust it for numbers like 120 to 150. I've never heard of anyone experimenting beyond 150. Can the pump really supply that? Does the adjustment mechanism, which allows you to set the pressure, will it go that far? I don't know. I'm hearing such good news about the people that have gone between 130 and 150. I haven't done that yet because I haven't bought that pressure gauge. It's a special kind of pressure gauge which has a fluid damping within the gauge to make sure it doesn't wiggle real fast. See, the actual oil coming out of the oil pump is slightly pulsating. And so it takes a special gauge to be able to read that accurately. And do those gauges go to 200 is a darn good question. So I don't think I would push it that far. I think by the time you get beyond 120, 130, it is my guess from what I'm hearing, you're getting 95% of the potential benefit of this approach as I see it, Dave. But as you and I pass back and forth the call letters of the guys who are in the business, who have got the knowledge, and as we discuss this further, we're going to discover things like that. I don't think we've got to go to 200, but it's an interesting proposal. Back to you, Gabe.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Dick, why do you say that it's pulsating? You know, what you have is two gears that are more or less meshed. It's that type of a deal for the pump. So it should be a continuous flow.
A very close to continuous flow, Paul. As each one of those pairs of gears open up and you get an amount of oil squirting out, it is a very slight pulsation in my opinion. I don't think it's a completely smooth operation like you would have with a rotary scroll pump that you've got on a certain kind of air conditioner, although even that I think has a pulsation to it. I'm guessing the pulsation is minor, but I think there is one there, is my opinion, Paul, but you're right. If the gears are really well designed, it should be a rather smooth flow. But I was told, though, that you should buy a gauge that's rated for that particular service so that it's easier to read. Back to you, Dave, for any further fills on this. And if need be, I can give you the list of call letters of the guys who showed a lot of knowledge on the subject, and they seem to be in the business. I could give you that list if you request it. KBQMAR, K2RIW.
I would really appreciate that list, Richard. One more thing that I'd like to say. How much percentage of efficiency improvement do you get with this type of fine-tuning of the oil burner? Back to you.
I'd like to say that I'm enough of a scientist that I made measurements before and after. I didn't do that. All I've got is anecdotal evidence, a gut feel. I know how many gallons per oil I used to burn per year. Assuming that each of my winters now are similar to before I made these modifications, I think I'm burning 30% less oil. Rough number. But I'm not positive about that. In that vicinity. The main thing, how much oil I burn is a factor. How much black soot is built up in my furnace is a factor. How much rumble and sound I have to put up, how much smell I have to put up with. I now have a furnace that has very little smell, a tan-colored soot inside of it. It's quiet. It runs reliably. And it seems to be burning less oil. Other than that, I'm happier. You see where I'm going. I know I've made improvement. I can't quite quantify it. Back to you, Gabe.
That's unbelievable how the soot turns to tan instead of just black. I've been seeing black for so many years. It's just, I can't believe it. That's much of an improvement that they'll actually make the soot brown at like one-tenth of the amount that originally accumulated.
Yeah, the total amount of soot is drastically less. As I said, the soot is a medium tan color, absolutely not black. When you're getting black soot, that is real unburnt oil. Pure and simple. The tips of the flame look black. The soot that builds up in the flue pipes is black. It shouldn't be that color. It's all unburnt oil. Properly burnt oil, as I said, is what little soot, there's always some fine metallic or rock-like, you know, very fine silt is in the oil, even after it's been through an extremely good filter. And that's the main reason, by the way, that you do change the nozzle once every year. It's false economy not to do that because the nozzle's only a couple of dollars. But the very fine grain-like material that manages to get through the filters is slowly eroding that nozzle. If you ever take a nozzle apart and look at it under a microscope, you'll be amazed at what technology is in there. Very finely machined channels that the oil has to flow through, which swirls it at a very high pressure, at a very high velocity, and swirls it and spins it as it comes out of that tiny little orifice that your eye can just barely see. When you take the sintered brass filter off the back of the nozzle, and the nozzle itself has got a simple screw in the center that unscrews, and you take it apart and you look at those two pieces under a microscope, as I said, you'll be mildly amazed at what technology is in there, and you buy that thing for like $3. So something of that high a technology that is slowly being eroded, it's false economy not to change it once per year. And maybe if you're a super conservative person and you run your furnace a whole lot of months per year, maybe you'll change it twice per year, but that's the main thing that your service person is supposed to do. Change the nozzle, clean out the furnace, clean out the flue pipes, make sure that the pressures and settings are right and whatever. And the methodology that they normally use for doing these settings, somehow it ends up wrong. Either they're hiring people that are not very skilled, or they're not doing it as good as they could because of mixed motivation. I'm not quite sure what's going on, but as I said, W2TRP was quite amazed as to the percentage of furnaces on Long Island, where he looked, that by his standards are being rather poorly set. I'll find that email. That
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I'll find that email that I had sent to Joe. I'll read you those call letters. It'll take me a couple of minutes while Joe is asking his question to find that, and so with a little bit of delay, you'll be getting that information. Back to you, Gabe, if you have any finals on this before we go over to Joe. KB2MAR, K2RIW.
Thanks so much, Richard. Sorry to make you run back and forth there. I really appreciate you doing this for me. One other question that I have, I don't want to put too much time in the subject here, is that our burner used to the actual circulation pump would turn on, run the water through the house, then shut off. The water would heat up in the chamber, and the pump would turn on again, run the water through the house, then turn off. Now the pump runs continuously. I notice the furnace stays on longer than it used to, and we're using more oil, obviously, because the system keeps running. And the pump stays on continuously rather than intermittently. So I want to see what happened from when the technician came to do service, and he rewired the system wrong. I want to look into that and how to make that pump turn on only when it has to. Back to you.
Yes, my understanding of a hot water fired system, mine, by the way, is a warm air system, but in the case of a hot water system, my understanding is that your thermostat on a multi-zone house, when it demands heat for a particular set of rooms, it's really giving a command to the circulating pump to circulate the water through those particular baseboard radiators. That, in turn, the circulating of that water will cool the water back at the main jacket of the furnace, and when the main jacket of the furnace falls below a certain temperature, the furnace itself turns on, the flame turns on. So my understanding is that the thermostat is supposed to be turning on and off those circulating pumps. That's the way the system normally works. If I understand you correctly, that circulating pump is running continuously, which shows one of two things. Either that thermostat is not being satisfied, or there's some kind of a blockage by which insufficient hot water is being allowed to flow through those particular baseboard radiators, and therefore those particular rooms are not coming up to temperature. So with your investigation, Gabe, do you think the rooms that have that particular thermostat that's running that particular circulator pump, do you believe those rooms are running colder than they should? I mean, for that circulating pump to run continuously, you would think that those particular rooms would become overheated. One other thing to worry about is that you should periodically take apart the baseboard radiator, make sure that it's not jammed with dust, so that it has a free flow of air. Back to you, Gabe.
Now, the funny thing is, see, you would think that the rooms would be too hot. But the way I see it is that that pump's always running, the water never gets a chance to get hot enough for it to make the house hotter. It will, but it'll take much longer, you know what I'm saying? Rather, when the pump shuts off for the water to reheat itself, then turn on again, you got a good blast of hot water going through the system. See, that's the way I see it. But everything, the temperature of the house, I've noticed, takes longer to achieve the right temperature. But I'm not too crazy about the situation with the pump running all the time. I never did that before. Our system is from way back. We had a way back when, they didn't have a hot water heater. What they used is the furnace to make the hot water for the house. So it was like a little setup hooked up to the furnace, which was a little an outboard heater core for the water, for the hot water for the house, way back then. But then they got a gas-fired hot water heater, and then when that piece started to rust, where the heater core was hooked up to the system, the technician took everything apart, and I think it took apart one of the sensors that sent the temperature of the hot water from that core. I don't see it has anything to do with it, because that core isn't being used anymore. It was used a long time ago. But maybe he somehow touched wires for a sensor or something like that. I'm not sure. Back to you.
Comment, Glenn.
Okay, Glenn, I'll get you in a second. The part of the story you just gave us, Gabe, doesn't completely ring true. Even if all of the circulator pumps in the house ran continuously, and common sense would lead you to believe that, hey, the water never gets a chance to get hot. There's something wrong with that story. If your furnace is running correctly and producing the right number of BTUs of heat, and if all of that heat is being dumped into the water, even if you're circulating the water too fast, and even if the water doesn't get a chance to come up to full temperature, all of that heat that's being dumped into the water has nowhere else to go except into your house. So the average temperature of all the rooms of your house must continuously increase if your furnace is running. Now, if the furnace is not running continuously while that circulating pump is running, then it suggests that that water being cooled by that baseboard radiator is for some reason not getting back to the furnace, because it would be causing cooling and therefore making it cycle on. When the jacket, the water jacket falls below a critical temperature that turns that thing on. So something doesn't ring true here. The possibility exists that the circulating pump is running continuously, but the impeller inside has broken and it's not really moving water. And that's one of the failure mechanisms, by the way. It can run continuously, not move the water. And so by convection, you're getting a little bit of hot water into the furnace and some heat is taking place. So if you check on, is that room coming up to normal temperature? Is the thermostat being satisfied? If the answer is no, then it suggests you're not moving that water back to the furnace. Let's see now, who is it that just signed in? Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
All right, let's bring WS1 unless I dub it.
Okay, go ahead, Paul, first.
Okay, very good. Yeah, initially you would think the aquastat, that's what that's called, the aquastat, that regulates the boiler temperature. You have a high and low setting on that. You would think, well, okay, it's pointing to that, but apparently he might not be circulating much water at all. The pump could actually have a failure in it, or you might have air in the system. Might have to bleed the system out. Would have quite a bit of air. Might be a monoflow system. I don't know what type of hydronic system he has. If it's a monoflow system with all these monoflow keys all over, those things get clogged up. And you might be just circulating water around the main and not getting up into the elements, the heating elements. So he's got quite a few things to check. To check as a possibility. I agree. Yeah. I mean, if the water was going through the house, through the elements, eventually it would heat up. As long as the heat has to go somewhere. As long as that burner is coming on, if he goes down and sees that burner on a regular basis, the way it used to be, the heat has to go somewhere. Dick. He's got a lot of things to check. By the way, once you get everything squared away on your aquastat, I notice a lot of service people leave the house and they leave that a little on the high side. You probably, I go down about 10 degrees on the high and low side of mine, and that saves quite a bit of fuel per year, especially if you have a tankless coil system. Back to you, Dick. WS2S.
Very fine, Paul. Very good information there. Now that you understand some of the physics of what's going on here, Gabe, one of the things that I would do is find out that circulating pump that's running continuously. Is the water, when you put your hands on the pipes, on the input end and the output end of that circulator pump, are you feeling the hot pipe showing that hot water is going through? It's really being moved. And maybe you're going to have to move your hand a few feet downrange to make sure you're not just feeling the local convection of hot water. Is the water of that pump that runs continuously really being circulated? Is that particular baseboard radiator getting hot to the touch? If not, it suggests the hot water is not getting there. If the hot water is getting there and that baseboard radiator is coming up to the right temperature, a thermometer can tell you that, then that room should be coming up to the right temperature. And when it comes up to the room temperature, right temperature, the thermostat in that room should turn off and stop the demand for that particular circulating pump. So there's a number of things to check. And Paul was telling you to worry about whether or not the aquastat back at your furnace itself, that's the thing that's trying to keep the furnace at some particular constant temperature. And maybe the answer is 180 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm not sure. I don't have a hot water system. But by the way, I have a separate oil-fired hot water heater for my domestic hot water, and I've set it about 15 degrees cooler, when you've got a properly operating oil-fired hot water heater that's properly sized, I cannot run out of hot water when I take showers. I'll admit that if I ran the water as fast as possible and filled the tub with water three times in a row, I'm pretty sure I'd run out of hot water. But nobody nowadays runs a shower anywhere near at that rate. I can run the shower continuously. In other words, I have three people in my house, occasionally four, who will take a shower all consecutively on the same morning. And the system never runs out of hot water, even though I set the Aquasat on the hot water, separate fired hot water heater, 10 or 15 degrees colder than it used to be set. Now I'm using less of the insulation of that hot water heater and losing less of the heat of that system, and makes it run a little bit more efficiently. That's the right
repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's the right thing to do in the summertime, because extra heat coming off of your hot water heater is heating your house and making you use more air conditioning. In the wintertime, I'm not so sure that's the right thing to do, because any of the heat that's being lost by your pipes, whether they're insulated or not, or your hot water heater, that heat is going into your house. Yes, it's being dumped into the basement, but I guarantee it drips through the floor up to the rest of the house. So as long as the system is burner-wise running efficiently, I'm not so sure you've got to cut back the temperature on the hot water heater in the wintertime. But in the summer, I do recommend you do it, because it's going to adjust the amount of air conditioning you're going to use. I have found the email that has the list of call letters of so-called oil burner experts. When you're ready to write, Dave, give me a shout, and I'll feed that to you. KB2MAR, K2LIW.
K2LUQ.
If it's unready, go ahead.
Okay, I heard KB2OGQ. What is your question or comment, sir? And what is your name, please?
It's Rick here. It's KC2LUQ. Do I have the floor?
KC2OEQ. If you're on this subject, yes. If you want to be on the list of people who are going to get to, then not immediately. Back to you, Rich.
It's Rick. It's a funky uniform Quebec here. I usually listen, but I thought Kinzane failed to help this fella. What he has here is two different systems. One system that keeps the water temperature, that's the Aquasat. Personally, I feel I could share with you. I run mine 150 on the low side and 170 on the high side. Like you said, by checking the temperature of the outgoing water with the temperature of the water on the return, you can kind of tell what's going on at the pipes. The circulating pump also could be rotting away, actually, the mains. The circulator is always put on the return side because that's where the water is the coolest. And this is for to get the most life out of the motor so that they don't burn up. The other thing is that you should know is that it would take a little, if you're running a little cooler, which I like to do, it'd take a little longer for the house to heat up. But once it's up there, it stays up there. And I think it's, personally, I found that to be much more efficient. Also, if he has well water or hard water situation, he could have a buildup inside the pipes, which, by the way, I've seen this phenomenon. The material that goes up inside the pipes is effectively an insulator, which could also be compounding the problem. Back to you.
Okay, sir, please give me your call letters and name one more time, and thank you for the information. Back to you, sir.
Rick, Kilo Cycle 2 Lucky Uniform, Quebec. Well water. Just remember that I didn't catch the fellow who had the problem. I didn't catch his call. I'm sorry. But the circulator is always on the return, and they do that so because the water comes back a few degrees cooler, and that makes the life of the circulator pump last longer. They're two, not that they wouldn't affect each other, but there's two different systems. One's
just, you know, the water doesn't touch each other. It just runs through a coil and up into the booms and back down again. The circulator is always pulling rather than pushing, because if it was pushing, they wouldn't last as long as they do, because they'd run a lot hotter. Back to control wing.
Okay, am I talking to Kilo Charlie 2, Lucky Uniform Quebec? Is that true, Floyd?
That's true, and I go by Rick usually. Go ahead.
Okay, that must be your middle name. And I see you're in Middle Island, and that is my hometown. Used to live on Church Lane. Another whole subject. Okay. I know that, sounds like, by the way, Rick, are you in the business where you do this kind of maintenance, out of curiosity? If so, I'm going to add you to the list.
No. I don't do that. I rebuilt a few houses, and in doing that, you know, had to mess with the oil burners. So, I got a funny story about that. I'll share that with you when I have a couple minutes some other time here. But, yeah, I didn't have a choice. I couldn't afford an oil burner guy, so I had to do it myself here. So I learned pretty quickly.
And I wonder if, Rick, you've come to the same conclusion I have. It is not rocket science. To learn the technology is not that difficult, and to have control of it, I mean, I get a strong sense of confidence knowing that I'm not vulnerable to suddenly losing heat in the house. If at 3 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Eve my oil burner fails, I have no compunction to go down there, take my spare parts, and fix it. You try getting an oil burner repairman on that particular hour of that particular day. Your family is going to, they better be wearing some very long, warm clothing. Okay, gave one of the list of call letters. I may have a couple of errors here, but here's the call letters of the people who signed in back in July of this year and gave us an awful lot of this information, Gabe. The first guy who I respect an awful lot is Irwin, Whiskey 2, Tango, Romeo, Papa. The next guy is Rich, Kilo, Charlie 2, Lima, Tango, Yankee. Next guy was Bob, Whiskey 2, Papa, November, Juliet. Another guy who had a lot of information was Greg, Kilo, Charlie 2, Quebec, Quebec, Alpha. Another guy with a lot of information was Charlie, Kilo, Charlie 2, Mike, India, Quebec. And now these last three, there's a little bit of doubt as to the accuracy I've got of their call letters. Bernie, Kilo 2, Yankee, Oscar. Frank, Kilo 2, I think it was Romeo, Sierra, Oscar. But I couldn't find him in the QIZ.com. And the last guy was Dan, Kilo Charlie 2, Lima, Yankee, Uniform. Each of these guys who signed in July when we were on this subject, all of them seem to have quite a bit of contributing information, and I tried to give you the compendium of that information. See if you need some fills on that, Gabe. KB2 Mike, Alpha Romeo, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
Thanks so much for the queries. And I received everything clear. Everything's written down okay. So no need to repeat all that again. Thanks so much, Richard. And one more thing. When the furnace is off, right? Now, when the thermostat tells the furnace to turn on again, the pump pumps the water out, you know, nice and hot, obviously when it comes out from the main, from the output of the system. Now, I touch the pipe from the input, and the water comes almost as hot as it did when it came out. Of course, it's going to be cooler because it went to the system. You're going to lose some heat in the water. After like 10 minutes or so, not even 10 minutes, 5 minutes, the water coming out of the output pipe is about 120 degrees instead of like 150, 120, 125 degrees. And it stays that way for quite a while until like near the end of its cycle, about a half hour from then, something like that, which I find ridiculous. That's what I'm saying about the pump running continuously. The water pumps through the house fine. It's a single pump system. It pumps from, you know, from the basement all the way to the third floor of the house and down.
down, of course, back to the input where the pump is hooked up to the system. Like I said, the first time it turns on, when the water comes back, it's hot. But then the system takes too long to heat the water up again